Welcome to Mysteries, Myths, and More. I'm your narrator, Joyce Keller Walsh. My intention is to use this podcast to tell a story each month, sometimes fiction, sometimes not, that I hope you'll find interesting, engaging, and provocative.
Episode number 24, part 2, May 2024. It Can't Happen Here, part 2, Betrayal. Dorothy Thompson's role in anti-Nazism and anti-totalitarianism cannot be underestimated, nor can her influence on her husband be minimized. Would there be a book, It Can't Happen Here, without Dorothy Thompson's writings? Hard to say, given the turbulent politics of the 1930s. But Sinclair Lewis did what the best authors do, take an idea and make it his own. Lewis was one of the best authors of his day. His dystopian novel, part parody, part realistic, was immediately popular, with more than 300,000 copies sold. It was, according to Lewis's biographer Mark Shore, another sensation. And because of all the political upheaval at the time of the book's publication in 1935, it became a cause célèbre. But it's not my intention to give you a book report, or only insofar as Lewis presents the ominous rise step by step of totalitarianism in a fictional United States, and its dark and dangerous effect, as seen through the eyes and experience of one Doremus Jessup, the 60-year-old editor of a country newspaper. The story is set in Vermont, where Lewis had a farm, in the fictional town of Fort Beulah, population about 20,000, a town not unlike the rural small town in the Midwest where Lewis grew up. Time is an evening in May 1936, which would make it 7 months after the publication of the novel. Doremus Jessup, the main protagonist, is, quote, a littleish man, skinny, smiling, well-tanned, with a small gray mustache, a small and well-trimmed gray beard. In a community where to sport a beard was to confess oneself a farmer, a Civil War veteran, or a Seventh-day Adventist, Doremus's detractors said that he maintained the beard just to be highbrow and different, to try to appear artistic. Possibly they were right. What Sinclair Lewis portrays is a man who is a Yankee skeptic, with roots firmly planted in New England soil, a family man with a rather simple, albeit well-meaning wife, three grown children, two strong-willed daughters and a weak-willed son, and a secret rebellious mistress whom he truly loves. Jessup likes being a bit of a gadfly, likes to consider himself an intellectual because he reads more books than most of the rest of the town's citizenry. And he writes news and editorials in the newspaper that circulates throughout Fort Beulah and perhaps a little beyond. But Doremus, as Lewis refers to him throughout, is not heroic. It's essential to the story that Doremus is an educated everyman, comfortable with his way of life the way it is, observing and commenting on society, but not an activist. Lewis introduces most of the main characters in Chapter 1 via the annual ladies' dinner of the Fort Beulah Rotary Club, during which the participants express their political and patriotic views that will define them as time goes on. Lewis straddles the line between mocking their superficial flag-waving and hinting at the potential danger of extreme jingoism. As General Edgeways tells the Rotarians, I don't altogether admire everything Germany and Italy have done, but you gotta hand it to them. They've been honest enough and realistic enough to say to the other nations, just tend to your own business, will you? We've got strength and will, and for whomever has those divine qualities, it's not only a right, it's a duty to use them. Nobody in God's world ever loved a weakling, including that weakling. Thus, from the beginning, Lewis lays out what will become the plot of the book. And he sets the stage for what follows. What follows is a kind of compliance of the public with the general's rhetoric, which then becomes embodied in the person of Senator Buzz Windrip. Actually, more than compliance, Lewis shows a willing, self-selected audience for authoritarianism. From time immemorial, philosophers, theologians, and writers have examined and parsed the conflict between good and bad. Often good and bad are depicted in two opposing characters embodying the two concepts. We can read this throughout literary history, from the Bible right down to the Harry Potter saga, where the young protagonist, Harry Potter, is confronted by the bully Draco Malfoy and the rivalry between their two Hogwarts houses, Gryffindors and Slytherin. It's a familiar theme, even a current one. Doremus Jessup would like to dismiss Edgeways as silly or annoying or typically inconsequential, except for two things: the rising anti-Semitism he sees everywhere, and the following that Edgeways and Winder are assembling. As one of Doremus's friends scolds, "This is a mighty serious hour, and it's time for you to cut the cackle and join the really responsible citizens." To which Doremus replies, "Yes, I agree, it's a serious time. With all the discontent there is in the country to wash him into office, Senator Winthrop has got an excellent chance to be elected president next November. And if he is, probably his gang of buzzards will get us into some war just to grease their insane vanity and show the world that we're the huskiest nation going. If Bishop Prang, our Savonarola and a Cadillac 16, swings his radio audience and his League of Forgotten Men to Buzz Winthrop, Buzz will win. People will think they're electing him to create more economic security. Then watch the terror. God knows there's been enough indication that we can have tyranny in America. Wait till Buzz takes charge of us, a real fascist dictatorship." "Nonsense, nonsense," snorted his friend. "That couldn't happen here in America, not possibly. We're a country of freemen." "The answer to that," suggested Doremus Jessup, "is the hell it can't. Why, there's no country in the world that can get more hysterical, yes, or more obsequious than America. Look how Huey Long became absolute monarch over Louisiana, and how the Right Honorable Mr. Senator Berzelius Winthrop owns his state. Listen to Bishop Prang and Father Coughlin on the radio, divine oracles to millions. Remember how casually most Americans have accepted Tammany grafting and Chicago gangs, and the crookedness of so many of President Harding's appointees. Could Hitler's Bunch or Winthrop's be worse? Remember the Ku Klux Klan? Remember how trainloads of people have gone to enjoy lynchings? Not happen here? Prohibition shooting down people just because they might be transporting liquor? No, that couldn't happen in America. Why, where in all history has there ever been a people so ripe for a dictatorship as ours? We're ready to start on a children's crusade, only of adults, right now, and the Right Reverend Abbots Winthrop and Prang are all ready to lead it." "Well, what if they are?" another of Doremus's friends says. "Why are you so afraid of the word fascism, Doremus? Just a word, just a word. And might not be so bad with all the lazy bums we got panhandling relief nowadays and living on my income tax and yours. Not so worse to have a real strong man like Hitler or Mussolini, like Napoleon or Bismarck in the good old days, and have him really run the country and make it efficient and prosperous again. In other words, have a doctor who won't take any back chat, but really boss the patient and make him get well, whether he likes it or not." "Yes," said another of his friends, "didn't Hitler save Germany from the red plague of Marxism? I got cousins there, I know." "Hmm," said Doremus, as often Doremus did say it. "Cure the evils of democracy by the evils of fascism. Funny therapeutics. I've heard of their curing syphilis by giving the patient malaria, but I've never heard of their curing malaria by giving the patient syphilis." In historian Timothy Snyder's book On Tyranny, he outlines what steps lead to authoritarianism. The first step is the public's, quote, anticipatory obedience, unquote. That is, the willingness of people to comply in advance to a new authority. Sinclair Lewis, whether by observation or imagination, gives to his characters the willingness to accept fascism. The second step in Snyder's outline has to do with institutional resistance, or lack thereof, to authoritarianism. He writes, "We tend to assume that institutions will automatically maintain themselves against even the most direct attack. This was the very mistake that some German Jews made about Hitler and the Nazis after they had formed a government." Snyder quotes from a leading German Jewish newspaper of the day, "We do not subscribe to the view that Mr. Hitler and his friends will deprive German Jews of their constitutional rights, nor enclose them in ghettos, nor subject them to jealous and murderous impulses of the mob. The mistake, Snyder writes, is to assume that rulers who came to power through institutions cannot change or destroy those very institutions, even when that is exactly what they have announced they will do. In Lewis's book, he portrays the first institution to be affected is higher education. Doremus is informed by a friend who is a faculty member at the local college that the Board of Trustees voted that any member of the teaching staff who criticizes the militia training at the college may be fired. Doremus did not take that news as alarming, not yet. Meanwhile, Buzz Windrip promised that every person in the country would have several thousand dollars a year, shades of Huey Long, and like Long, Windrip never did keep his promise. Buzz Windrip, with the help of his secretary and power broker, a man named Lee Saracen, a kind of combination Joseph Goebbels and Heinrich Himmler, secured the party's nomination for president and went on to win the election over the decent, middle-of-the-road incumbent. As president of the United States, Windrip begins to consolidate his power and, with Saracen's guidance, appoint loyalists to the courts and all positions in government. He quickly begins to choke off all potential dissent and raises his own militia called the Minutemen, or the MMs, likened to Hitler's SS. And like the stormtroopers in the Gestapo, the loyalists become increasingly violent. Dissenters are initially brought to trial, but invariably found guilty, then murdered or remanded to prison, then to concentration camps. There is no freedom of speech in Windrip's America. According to the United States Memorial Holocaust Museum, Nazi officials established the first concentration camp, Dachau, on March 22, 1933, for political prisoners. It was later used as a model for an expanded and centralized concentration camp system managed by the SS. Lewis would have known about the concentration camps by 1935 in order to write so compellingly about Doremus's imprisonment after the small-town newspaper editor wrote critically about what was happening in Windrip's murderous dictatorship. The press, the bulwark of liberty, was controlled by the new authoritarian administration, and journalists, as well as other critics, were jailed. Thus, whether it be the educational system or other communication systems, they were brought under the control of the fascist administration. There is a formula for dictatorship that Lewis observed and intuitively realized in the novel. It is not simply a betrayal of democracy by a tyrant. Lewis depicts the eagerness of people to consent to tyranny. But the author also holds out hope for resistance with the deposing of Windrip by his then Secretary of State, Lee Saracen, who in turn was shot to death in a coup d'etat by the Secretary of War General, formerly Colonel, Dewey Haig. The Haig presidency was no less totalitarian and even more militant as he attempted an invasion of Mexico with the intent of annexing it. But this caused some pockets of rebellion amongst the American citizenry. Not enough, however, to topple the new dictator. Who then in Lewis's story will topple the new dictator? Underground efforts rest on persons such as Doremus Jessup, who nearly dies in a concentration camp, escapes with the help of his friends and family, and flees to Canada. Doremus, never before heroic, understands that he needs to take action against the dictatorship. He returns to America to promote the resistance. Lewis ends his novel with, "So Doremus rode out, saluted by the meadowlarks, and onward all day to a hidden cabin in the northern woods where quiet men awaited news of freedom." And still Doremus goes on in the red sunrise, for a Doremus Jessup can never die. We all like a happy ending, whether it's from an extraterrestrial invasion, as in the movie Independence Day, or in the TV series The Plot Against America, based on the 2004 Philip Roth novel of the same name. In the case of Lewis's novel, we don't know the outcome of Doremus's efforts as a secret agent. Unfortunately, we know from history that brave men and women do die. We need not look any further than the 2024 death of Alexei Navalny in Putin's Russia. And we know that sometimes the battle is lost and dictatorship wins. There are enough examples of this in past and present history. But I think Lewis's point is that whatever the cost, we really must not let that happen here.
If you like this podcast, please download and subscribe. It's free, and you'll find it on your favorite directories such as Apple, Google, Stitcher, TuneIn, and more. To learn more about me and my books, go to joycewalsh.com.